Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Just a quick note before we get started. If you're enjoying the content here on Thoughts on Record, we'd love a rating or a review on iTunes. It really helps us to grow the podcast and to continue to provide you with high-quality content week over week. Stacey Cosmerly, PhD, is a clinician at the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. She has a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Ottawa and a master's in applied psychology from Laurentian University. Ms. Cosmerly is highly involved in the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Program and the Adult Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder Programs at the OICBT. She uses primarily DBT and CBT approaches to therapy, integrating her past training in emotion-focused therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy when appropriate. During her master's degree, Ms. Cosmerly worked closely with Dr. Adele LaFrance, one of the developers of emotion-focused family therapy, and was involved in community outreach related to this. Since 2013, she has been involved in delivering workshops on emotion coaching, which teaches skills for parents and caregivers to respond effectively to their children's and loved ones' emotions. All right, Stacey Cosmerly, PhD, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me back.
Yes, it's so nice to have you back. You were so nice to come on. I think in one of the very earliest episodes of Thoughts on Record, we had a really cool conversation on psychedelics and psychotherapy. And today we're going to attempt to do a deep dive on a topic that has become one of my favorites in psychotherapy and really psychology itself, emotions. As the regular listener probably knows, time permitting, there's usually a series of questions that I like to ask guests at the end of the podcast. One of them is, what have you been most wrong about in your career? And I think upon reflection, I would definitely say that early in my career, I did not give emotions nearly enough attention therapeutically. I think this has been a function, or it was a function of both my own discomfort with emotions, both in myself as well as the client. But, you know, through a lot of hard work and having experienced some really beautiful and wonderful change moments in therapy with clients, I can honestly think of nothing more important in a therapeutic process than ultimately trying to move emotions with emotions, as Les Greenberg, the great EFT guru would say. If it feels pertinent and appropriate, I think I'm going to try and sprinkle in a little bit of neuroscience. I know Dr. Joe Ledoux's model of emotions is absolutely fascinating, something that's been on my radar quite a bit lately. He really strongly argues that emotions are a distinctly human experience and that it's the sense of self and consciousness that ultimately is required to experience what we call emotions. It might be something very different in animals, or at the very least is something we can't measure in the same way we'd be able to with the humans. Anyway, we'll see where we get with that. So, Stacey, to begin, I thought we could first define what we mean by the term emotion in the context of psychotherapy. So how do you think about emotions within that context?
Yeah, the way I see it is, the physiological response that we experience in our bodies in response to both either an internal or an external trigger. I usually kind of conceptualize emotions as having several different components. So a physiologically body felt sense of some sort. Usually they signal our attention towards either a need, or they motivate our action in some way, or they communicate something either to ourselves or to others. And in theory, if we're listening to our emotions effectively and we respond to that need, or we communicate that effectively, they help us adaptively survive. So they're wired to help us get along in tribes, get along with each other, and make adaptive choices in our life. And so in psychotherapy, we see emotions, we look for them. We're constantly looking for cues on a client's face. And we're looking often enough for whether the emotion they're expressing matches what, the adaptive emotion that would make sense in the situation that they're describing, because so often they don't quite match up. And that's a lot of our work, is helping them understand their emotions differently so that we can get that match, so we can use the emotions the way they're intended to, as information and as motivation.
So I think a couple interesting points in there that are worth making. The first is that emotions are probably, seem to be this aggregate experience where we're knitting together a whole bunch of different sensations, both cognitively and physically, together for the ultimate end user experience of being angry or sad or whatnot. I know, again, I just referenced it, but in Joe Ledoux's model, he talks about how the amygdala will generate a lot of the physiological responses and some of the behavioral responses in a very unconscious and sort of way. And so they do these experiments where they will present stimuli to the brain in such a fashion that only the amygdala is able to perceive it and it's not able to be perceived consciously. And what will happen is people will get the physiological activation of seeing the picture of a snake. And they'll, so they start to sweat, their heart rate will go up, but they don't have the complement experience of fear to go with that. Mm. And I think it's an important point in the sense that, you know, people often have the experience of maybe doing a public speaking task. Certainly this has been true for me, where I'll have the physiological activation, but without the experience of fear to go with that. Now, we can also have the physiological activation and the experience of fear to go with this. So they can go together. But I just wanted to point out that it seems to be that our emotions are ultimately sort of these aggregated experiences of knitting together a whole bunch of different things. Stacey, what do you think about that take or that way of looking at it?
Yeah, I think the research you're talking about too, when we separate kind of the cognitive component from the automatic physiological component, I'm hoping to talk a little bit later about understanding how we learn to regulate. And we know that when we can add that cognitive piece, we can label the emotion in words using language, and that language piece of our brain gets activated. It helps soothe the physiological piece. So I think I really like how you're highlighting that it's more often not automatic in our body. We don't necessarily have control over it, which is a really important thing, I guess, is that for us as psychotherapists, because we can't directly change emotion per se. We can only change emotion via other routes.
Exactly. And one thing I wanted to ask you about that, just to pick up on what you mentioned a second ago, if emotions are evolutionarily prescribed, why is it sometimes that we do have so much trouble mapping on our emotional response to the actual demands or circumstances that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think there's a big cultural piece. I think emotions are developed, you know, there's a natural biological wiring in our body that's guided to help us survive. But we live in this culture that's incredibly emotionally avoidant and experientially avoidant. So where we aren't comfortable talking about our feelings, we have quite a bit of stigma about emotions that are not happy all the time. I grew up on the adage of Hakuna Matata, just basically stuff it down and only focus on the good. And so our parents and our parents' parents didn't know how to respond to our emotion cues. And so the wiring gets a bit off when our emotions aren't responded to effectively. Is it okay if I go into that and talk a little bit about how
absolutely
developed?
Absolutely.
So my understanding is, you know, we're born these little blobs, babies that are pretty helpless, and we're wired to attach to our primary caregivers, because without them, we won't survive, right? We can't take care of ourselves, unlike any other animal that can walk and feed itself pretty soon after birth. And so we experience sensations in our body that we express by crying or making facial expressions. And it's up to our caregivers to take care of us and to try to, you know, become detectives as to what it is that we're feeling so that we can meet the needs of the infant. And so often, you know, unfortunately, based on parents' own experiences and the demands of parenting and mismatches even between the sensitivity level of an infant and a parent, parents are going to get it wrong a lot of the time. And it's not that no one's fault, but if things are gotten wrong too often, especially as we as infants start to develop language, we start to associate certain cues within our body with wrong external outputs, so wrong needs, wrong ways of expressing. So to make this more concrete, if every time I cried because I was sad, my parents fed me, might make me feel a little bit more comfortable in the second, so I might stop expressing the sadness through tears. But those wires in my system are getting a bit crossed. And then if this happens over time, or if every time, you know, as I become a toddler and I develop language and I can start expressing my emotion via language, my parents, based on their own discomfort with emotions, or my environment as a whole, based on our environment, our cultural discomfort with emotions, if I get a response of not attuned to my needs, so if I show up with a broken toy as a child and I'm sad and my body feels like tight and heavy and slouched over, and I come to mom and dad and I say, oh, I'm so sad, I broke my toy, and I get a response that's dismissive, like, well, think of all the kids who don't have toys, or you shouldn't have been playing with it so rough, or you know, get over it, or just maybe overly all you poor thing and over smothering me with love. Again, any of these one-off instances doesn't have a huge impact, but over time, now I've, you know, when I have this response that doesn't actually make me feel any better, that actually makes me feel maybe a bit ashamed for my emotional response, that doesn't fix my broken toy, and makes me feel disconnected from the people that I'm looking to as co-regulators to help me figure out what the heck's going on in my little body. Over time, you know, the emotion doesn't go away. The physiological sensations that cued that emotion are still there. They're swimming around. And I start to have to figure out ways in my little tiny brain how to push those emotions down more and more and more, so that I can feel a little bit better and get along with my day. And so when that pattern happens often enough, I start to rely on avoidance and pushing down emotions, or it becomes safer for me to hide those feelings or to go distract myself with something else, instead of trying to express them and use them adaptively as they're meant to communicate and to motivate. So the wires get crossed and I start not listening to my internal cues.
That's such a fascinating way of looking at it. And a couple of thoughts that came up for me during this. I had Dr. Jennifer Karp on the podcast previously, and I think one of the best tips she gave in the whole podcast, and I use it all the time, is to always validate the feelings. There's no wrong feelings, but then you can have a discussion about maybe redirecting behavior. And we're obviously talking about it in a child scenario here too, but I think that works with adults as well, right? Like, people have to be seen and heard first, then you're in a position maybe to make a suggestion about, hey, like, maybe next time you can try this or that, and redirect a little bit. But I think accurately decoding the experience of another person is incredibly therapeutic and incredibly constructive, and really works quite well. Another thought that came up for me when you were outlining the model, Stacey, was I think we often use the term emotional, quote unquote, as a pejorative, like it has a negative connotation to it. But it strikes me, in a system like this that you've described, it's an incredibly sophisticated transfer of information system, right? Like, it's not just these sort of macro experiences that are unbridled and out of control, or, you know, run really hot, or are completely non-linear and illogical. They are actually really sophisticated methods of communicating information, both of what's going on with the person as well as in the environment. And you look at the dance that parent and child are trying to navigate, it's incredibly complex, but also incredibly useful if you can get it right.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. Again, if we bring it back to the stigma around emotions, I think there's this adage that they are irrational, that they are kind of, to be emotional is labeled as a bad thing. And yet emotions are such valuable pieces of information. They help us stay together. Right. I find it very helpful to think of, you know, if we think of the core emotions and emotional facial expressions or physiological sensations associated with emotions are more or less universal, at least when it comes to the core. There's some argument over what the core, I think it's somewhere between 6 to 10 emotions are. But generally speaking, you know, babies recognize facial expressions just regardless of what culture you're in. You recognize emotional facial expressions. So they supersede language, and they're kind of universal. But again, so what they do, so sadness communicates to us that there's been a loss. It focuses our attention inwards. Our tears and our posture signals to others to come give us comfort, and so that we can be with our community when we've lost something and reflect on that thing that we've lost. And if we think of that, you know, I'd like to bring it back to caveman days almost. If we can go back to how would that be adaptive? Well, if I'm a parent and I've lost my child to an accident of some sort, and I'm, you know, over in the back of the cave, kind of hunched over and sad, my body language signals to me, to the rest of them, to come bring me in, to give me some space to grieve. And they'll kind of take care of me while I get through that loss, so that then they can take me back in and I can reconnect with that tribe and stay within a community, so I'm not likely to be, you know, lost myself. Anger communicates that someone's crossed a boundary or a goal has been blocked. And so if I've worked really hard to get this piece of meat that's going to keep my family safe for the winter, and my neighbor caveman comes and steals it away from me, the heat and the active feeling in my body that is anger would signal me to, you know, go club him over the head and get my piece of meat back to keep my family safe. Or, you know, in our current days, whatever the socially appropriate version of, hey, that wasn't okay, communicating that boundary would be. guilt tells me I've done something wrong that, you know, violates my moral code. And again, that icky feeling that I get when I've done something like that communicates to others that it's time to, you know, to learn from my mistakes, to make amends, to try my best not to do that again. Shame prompts me to hide parts of myself that would get me rejected from my community in some way, which I would argue in our culture today, we're often overly ashamed of things. And, you know, when we'll talk about shame that doesn't fit the facts of a situation, which we're kind of wired for these days. But again, in tribes, if there's something about me that's distasteful, it's going to get me rejected. That feeling in my body prompts me to hide that from others. And of course, fear keeps us safe, right? If we didn't feel fear in our bodies, we would never run away from bears. We would never pull our hand away from a stove. So we can see this evolutionary adaptive function of these emotions. And yet, because our, you know, generation after generation, we're not learning how to use them as such, our wires are getting all sorts of crossed, and there's gender differences and cultural differences and wire crossing. And then we get to this place where we feel these big feelings in our bodies and we have no idea what to do with them. In fact, so many of us are afraid of our own emotional experiences. It becomes a threat in and of itself because we don't have that sense of efficacy and competence of what does this mean? What do I do with it?
One of the challenges, it seems to me, in managing emotions, particularly in other folks, when we're interfacing with them, is what you see is not what you get in many instances, right? So a surface level reaction of anger may ultimately hide a real deep feeling of shame or hurt, right? And the likewise could be true as well, right? Someone who looks very sad on the surface could also be really quite angry underneath, mm-hmm. right? And not able to, you know, connect with that in that particular moment for reasons that can get very complex. Stacey, why is it that perhaps our body will choose to substitute in one emotion for another? And in a way, it seems kind of counterproductive, right? Like it shields us from actually getting our needs met. And oftentimes we're articulating distress when really we need to articulate a need, which maps onto a, perhaps a different emotion. What's up with that way of sort of that switcheroo kind of game that goes on there?
Yeah. And I call those kinds of switcheroos like miscues, right? When the emotion we're expressing and that we truly believe we're feeling, well, we are feeling, I suppose, but it doesn't seem to fit the facts of the situation. My understanding of it is, again, if we bring it back to this developmental model of, you know, how our environment responded to our emotional expressions when we were younger, we're highly adaptive beings. And so we're wired to prioritize our relationship with the people who care for us. And so we're going to bend and shape ourselves to make sure that mom and dad are all good, or, you know, our environment's all good, because if they're not all good, I, as a little blob that just cries and can't feed itself, am no good. Right. So I need to keep them safe so I can keep myself safe. And so if my expressions of vulnerability and sadness were met with, you know, shaming comments or anything other than a supportive comfort and reassurance, I maybe start learning that either I need to hide those vulnerable emotions, or it's safer for me to show more kind of stronger, active emotions like anger. And so I see this in, you know, to bring up, you know, a pattern I see often in kind of that toxic masculinity, I'm air quoting this here, that we sometimes see where more vulnerable emotions are presented as like anger and rage, because it's a safer, it's like a dog that's been cornered and is feeling really, really afraid and actually quite vulnerable. Well, the dog is going to show its teeth because that's going to keep it alive. And so we see sometimes individuals who show their teeth when they're actually feeling more vulnerable, because at one point in their life, that was the safer option. Now, exactly as you mentioned, though, that the problem with this is if I'm feeling sad, you know, the adaptive function of sadness is to signal for comfort, to signal for people to come towards me, to be, come close. And if I'm showing like back the heck off and like, you know, my teeth are showing, people are going to back away. So I'm actually getting the opposite of what I need in that moment. I'm pushing people further away. The opposite would be true, I guess, on the other end of the spectrum, when we signal tears or we signal sadness, anxiety, kind of more vulnerability, when indeed actually, you know, someone's crossed our boundary and the anger would make more sense. again, I'm using kind of gendered examples. I think of it sometimes, one of the examples I got is how we got here as a culture where we have these miscues. We think of men who went to war and saw all sorts of awful things and probably had so many emotions across the whole spectrum, including vulnerable emotions, anger, shame, guilt, rage, all of the things. And then they came back home and at no point did anyone say, okay, it's safe now. Let's process what you felt. And I want to talk in a second about what I mean when I say process, because I think of emotions like cycles that need, or like almost like digestion in some way. But people, you know, men got home from war and nobody gave them that space. So they just had to keep stuffing these feelings down. And again, when all the vulnerable feelings get stuffed, it was safer to present as a strong front of anger. Then that got passed on to their children and their children and their children. Women entered the workforce, or, you know, at some point, and we were taking jobs away from men. And so the learning was you better sit pretty and not cause a stink, because you're, you know, people aren't happy that you're here. And so we learn to when boundaries are crossed or when things are not going so well, to keep it down and to smile or to show the kind of more vulnerable, soft side, again, stuffing down those vulnerable emotions. But when in theory, we should be signaling anger when boundaries are crossed. I'm gendering these, and this is very oversimplified, and I don't want to make this a gendered discussion, but just kind of a one way of understanding part of the cultural narrative that got us to this place that we're at currently.
Stacey, I really think that's such a fascinating take. And again, like, it's obviously a very nuanced, complicated topic, but just looking at it through that one letter, narrow lens for a moment is so interesting. And it makes me reflect on my work that I do with first responders or military police. It's predominantly men. And what I always end up finding is that, and it leads into my next question, is that emotional inhibition actually ends up being more problematic than emotional dysregulation in that particular crowd. And often when we talk about family of origin types of issues, we are frequently seeing that there is a very emotionally inhibited father. One of my clients joked, my dad had two emotions, angry and angrier, right? So, you know, and that was his way of navigating life. And oftentimes what I find in my male clients is that they will look at their father with a lot of disrespect and see, you know, they'll project shame onto him, right? And not really respect him. But then in turn, they don't know how to manage their own shame. And they end up sort of cross-referencing shame. They end up sort of conflating shame with vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Right? The two sort of get knit together. Anyway, I could go on and on, but it's certainly a pattern I've seen quite a bit. So Stacey, I guess my next question, as I alluded to a moment ago, is, and we can talk about emotion dysregulation, I'm sure, in a few minutes, but emotional inhibition, it's a lot more subtle in my experience clinically. But to me, it's almost a bigger challenge, right? Because I tend to think of psychotherapy as almost like forging metal. And not that I've ever forged metal in my entire life, but I've watched a lot of Forge with Fire. So I'm going to give myself a... I'm basically an expert. I'm basically a blacksmith is what I'm trying to say. So the idea here is that, you know, you've got to heat, you've, in order to make the metal plastic and to be able to forge it into something useful, it's got to reach a certain temperature, a certain amount of heat has to be introduced into that medium in order to make it malleable. Too little heat, nothing happens. Too much heat, then things fall apart too, right? Like the metal just melts and it turns into like molten substance of some kind. So you've got to find that sweet spot. But I find with a lot of clients, especially those who are intellectually strong, they will hide in a stratum of intellectual engagement with the material. And we never, you know, we struggle to get the metal, quote unquote, hot enough to be able to kind of make it malleable and to get some movement there. And often, like you said before, people are really afraid of their own internal experience and they don't want to go there. They're afraid of what will happen, even if they know it's illogical, right? We know that it doesn't really have to do with logic. So what do you think about the clinical challenge of emotional inhibition? Where might that come from? And you've probably already alluded to this, but how do you think about emotional inhibition and how do you try and coax out the emotions from clients who are really locked down?
Yeah, I think I agree with you that it's in my opinion, more challenging to deal with clinically than, or to work with clinically than perhaps dysregulation, because dysregulation is there and it's alive. And at least for myself, I find we've got something hot to work with. We can do something here. And it's more about, like, you know, shaping and strategies and understanding and questioning what's going on. But when there's inhibition and there's so much logic, it's really hard. It's almost like the person is so disconnected from their internal experience and they live quite in their head, and there's a disconnect almost between head and body. And I understand that as having developed, again, through this model of, if it wasn't quote unquote safe to feel, to express emotions, if emotional needs weren't being met consistently, if there were some big traumatic experiences where the safe thing to do was to stuff those feelings down, my understanding often is these individuals have learned to keep them down, so much so that their brain is almost lost touch with them as a safety mechanism. So again, thank you, brain and body, for trying to help us survive at one point in our life. But then we get to be adults, and that disconnect, you know, for losing all that information to communicate to others, social relationships become so challenging when you don't know what you're feeling, or you're thinking about what you're feeling instead of being in the moment, being in your experience. You know, these individuals really struggle socially. They struggle with, you know, what I've seen is that often there's these physiological issues that are going on, but that are very undifferentiated, and we're thinking about them. It's very intellectualized. It's not really an emotion per se, but it's probably, you know, some undigested part of an emotion, but they're just disconnected from it. So my strategy more often than not has been to kind of use mindfulness based approaches to focus, to slow down, to tune in. Tons of education about emotions, tons of, normalizing this pattern of responding based on what we know about their developmental history. Of course, your brain, thank you, and body, thank you for getting you to this place that kept you safe. And let's see how it's not quite working now. And so it's a lot of tuning in, slowing down, creating safety, and really slow micro becoming scientists, trying to kind of go inward. I find it incredibly challenging work to do, but so rewarding when we can get individuals to tune in and to connect with what's going on for them. Often not necessarily for the first time, but for a first time where they feel competent and confident in that feeling.
It's incredibly powerful to be able to master one's own vulnerability. Yeah. There's a saying that I've taken to using with clients, and I can't remember if I made it up or I took it from somewhere. It doesn't really matter. But a lot of clients come in very defended but fragile, versus I would like them to be vulnerable and strong. Mm. You know, and I see those as and again, I do a lot of work with sort of that first responder population, and they come in very defended, right? But underneath, very fragile. Stacey, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is just a pick up on what we had talked about in our earlier podcast around psychedelics, one of the active ingredients that we had talked about pulling out of those protocols was like set and setting, the use of music, perhaps the atmosphere that one creates within the therapeutic space. Have you played around with using mood induction techniques or music or clips from evocative movies or anything like that to try and crack the code and get those emotions out of folks who are kind of locked down?
That's a really good question. I haven't in my therapy. I have been in research-based protocols, where we study the effect of mood on decision making or the effect of mood on eating habits. I used to be involved in research in that domain, where we would use emotionally evocative of films and see what happens. But no, that's actually a really good idea in therapy. I've done a lot more breath-based stuff, and the challenges of our current way of operating is everything's happening via teletherapy. And so sometimes you have the benefit of the client being in their own home, so they're a little bit more safe, but then you also have the challenges of maybe internet delays and lags. And so every now and then you get to a great moment where you're like, oh, I think we've got somewhere. And then you realize that the video stream has just frozen or something. I like that. Have you had experiences using those kinds of techniques, and have you found them to be helpful in getting people to go inward?
I have played around with them before, and a lot of times it comes up with naturally doing exposures, which are sort of an emotion induction technique, but very specifically to activate that fear schema, mm-hmm. and associated emotions. But I have suggested to clients to go on YouTube and find, you know, sad clips in movies or music that might really resonate with them. Part of the problem is that, you know, art is so personal, and what's going to resonate with one person is going to be completely laughable to another. Mm-hmm. Right. So what I do, I guess, ask for of the client is, hey, listen, here are the broad principles. I want you to go out and find the content that works for you. Without me trying to, like, a War on Drugs song that might be really, you know, effective for me may do absolutely nothing for them. So I think in part of learning how to take care of themselves, I invite people to go and find those things that are going to help them to get that stuff up and out. But I think what I've noticed is that the in tandem skill people need is a comfort with their vulnerability. Yeah. Cause the model that I try and use is, you know, tolerate your discomfort, which will allow you to feel vulnerable. When you're vulnerable, then you can really detect all of your emotions, and your emotions will tell you what you need. And then you can take care of yourself. Exactly. And like you said before, those folks who are really inhibited really struggle interpersonally. They can't decode themselves, and they probably can't decode others either. Right. Because there's again, that flow of information is just not happening in the way that it could be perhaps.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really good point there. I think I'm quoting Brené Brown, but you can't selectively numb emotions either. So these individuals who are inhibited when it comes to more vulnerable emotions are more often than not also inhibited when it comes to joy and pride and love. And so, you know, if we think of emotions as the color of life, and as well as information, as well as motivation to do the things we need to do to survive. But if everything is dulled, then the experience is quite challenging. And so the idea you're saying is, which is our goal as therapists, period, is not to get rid of emotions, but to experience the full range of emotions, to feel competent in handling the full range of emotions, to let them come and go, and to be able to tolerate difficult emotions when they come up. Because inevitably in life, painful things will happen, wonderful things will happen, and we need to be able to tolerate those feelings instead of stuffing them down and intellectualizing everything.
Stacey, with the full caveat that I might just be asking you to speculate, it's something I'm curious about. And it's to pick up on one of the points you made before, which I think is a great one. You'll see clients come in who are really physiologically activated, but in very non-specific ways, or they've got a lot of non-specific just sort of symptoms going on, or GI upset or muscle tension, things like that. And then, you know, through work, one day you may end up sort of connecting all the dots, and then the tears come, right? There's a real release. And again, just, it might be speculation. Do you feel that emotions are perhaps maybe less suppressed and more, and maybe it's more about disconnection, right? Like it's when you can line up the dots and then the whole circuit will light up, then you get access to it rather than it being there and being suppressed. And again, inviting speculation for sure. But what do you think about the idea of suppression versus being disconnected? And I'll give you a little bit more context here. You know, Joseph Ledoux, who's, you know, a very well-known neuroscientist, makes the point that, you know, brain areas on their own don't really do too much, right? Like if you were able to take out somebody's amygdala and put it in a petri dish and kind of keep it alive, bathe it in a solution of nutrients, like it wouldn't really be good for much. It's position uniquely within a set of circuits that actually confers its ability to function and do what it does. So again, this is making me wonder. I used to think a lot about, you know, people would suppress emotions and it would kind of go into their body. And again, that's very like non-scientific. But now I'm thinking maybe it's more a question of people being disconnected from themselves and the proper circuits not being sort of lined up perhaps in the way that they could be. What do you think about that?
I feel like I've thought of it from both perspectives because, you know, there's the adage of neurons that fire together, wire together, and in EFT. Or emotion focused therapy, which is a model where we're trying to activate overlearned emotion patterns. So usually those miscued emotion patterns. So, you know, for example, undifferentiated fear and shame, where I just feel this global sense of like unease and distress, but it's not really connected to anything. So I guess it brings up an important point that each emotion, usually they're short when they're wired and firing adaptively, they're short lasting kind of states that direct us towards, direct our attention towards something, motivate action. But when we're experiencing them as like long lasting kind of undifferentiated states, and we're not really sure what triggered it, I'm just kind of feeling off, or we've got this like physiological, unease in my body, but I'm not really sure what it is. In EFT, what we try to do is we try to you know, validate that or go towards that feeling such that we can eventually get the person to differentiate it and find the specific little pieces of cue that might trigger that emotion. We want to activate the adaptive emotional response. And so if there's overlearned shame of I am bad, I am unworthy, I am unlovable, we eventually activate kind of the sense of self-comfort and self-reassurance and saying, you know, I lived through really hard times that made me feel this way. And also I know that I'm lovable. And then we learn to soothe the self. And so we adapt, we evoke that adaptive neural circuit. And then that new neural circuit becomes more stronger, right? We get the neurons, the neuron bridge gets more thick. And so we're wiring, unwiring the old overlearned pattern, rewiring a new, more adaptive response. So I see that in terms of this idea of the disconnect. We're trying to, in therapy, evoke the effective neural circuit. But we also see, you know, there's lots of research suggesting that when we push, the way I conceptualize it is pushing it down, the suppression of emotions. But when it's, we experience it, we're not sure what to do with it, and we do something to avoid the emotion instead of using the emotion adaptively to motivate us, with that suppression of emotion, there's a lot of health consequences. We know that there's so many immunocompromised disorders associated with suppressed emotion. I know they've done research where they've done biopsies on lumps on women's breasts, and they've been able to differentiate malignant versus benign tumors based on levels of anger suppression. And so I see it both as like stuffing down emotions that goes into the body via affecting the immune system. And I also see it as the neural networks not being as connected as they can be, that we can, in therapy, help carve those pathways. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely does. And I think it's so interesting that when the emotions are miscued to what's going on, they tend to sort of wander around the mind for longer than they would otherwise. They're kind of, it's like, okay, something's wrong here, but it's struggling to find a home, right? It's having trouble landing. And like you point out, when we can make those connections in therapy, then it can kind of all land, right? It's like, okay, yeah. And then it's message received. It's good. Okay. And then we move forward. I also like the nuance that you had in there around, like, in that EFT model of developing the capacity to self-soothe, but also not remembering that, you know, sometimes we do err in our ways and we need to realize that, okay, like, yeah, we did make a mistake, but you know what? There was a context in which that happened. And probably the best solutions have the two of those knit together, right?
Right.
I think there's I've read so many books at this point, forget where I've heard what, but this notion of, you know, when a friend makes a mistake, keep the mistake, but keep the friend,
right?
Right? You have to keep both of those ingredients in there. Otherwise you're going to make a mistake. Like, don't throw out a friend for making a mistake, but at the same time, don't not acknowledge a wrong when something's been done to you, even if it's by someone who loves and cares about you.
Exactly. Which is so important for parenting, I think, right? So I teach emotion skills and parenting workshops every now and again. And on the same line of thinking, it's you punish the behavior. So when children do things that break the rules, the established communicated rules of the household, it is important to have consequences for breaking those rules. But you can still validate the emotion. So, you know, you're so angry, it seems so unfair that you're getting in trouble for playing too close to the water. It's not okay to play by the water. You know that you got to time out for this, but you know, yes, you're so angry, this feels so unfair. And you can validate the feeling while still punishing the behavior. I feel like that kind of fits in that line of thinking.
Exactly. I think that would really help facilitate that mapping perspective. Stacey, are you familiar with the book? I'm going to get the title wrong, but I'll get it roughly right. Orchid Children and Dandelion Children.
No,
actually. It's by Thomas Boyce.
No.
Basically, the model, he's a pediatrician, and the idea is that there are a subset of children within the normal distribution of children who are born with really quite reactive nervous systems. So you put them in a novel situation with a new caregiver, like a teacher or something like that, they'll show the biggest cortisol responses. They'll show the biggest increase in galvanic skin response. They'll show the biggest increase in heart rate. And what's interesting is that, so these so-called ORCID kids, they tend to do worse in environments that are impoverished and not very nurturing, but they tend to excel greatly in environments that are very nurturing and supportive. So the idea is that they're literally, quote unquote, thin skinned. They absorb whatever is in the environment either way, in the same way that their immune function will be worse in poor environments, but it will actually be better under really good conditions. Versus you have dandelion children who are more thick skinned. They're less reactive to what's going on in the environment. And really, it doesn't really matter what's going on. They're just going to be themselves, right? And really what differentiates the two groups is the emotional, I shouldn't say emotional reactivity. It's the physiological reactivity, but we can also assume there's an emotional, quote unquote, reactivity on top of that. Is that something that you see clinically, like even in adult clients or in any of the parenting work that you've done? How do you think about the temperament or the reactivity of the child in terms of nurturing them along the path of emotional regulation and being comfortable with vulnerability?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And as you were talking about that, I just recently read Mark Brackett's Permission to Feel, and he references the ORCID and dandelion children. And a really good kind of easy psychoed book for individuals looking for information on emotions. But the way, so I characterize the more ORCID children, the ones who are a little bit more sensitive to their environments, both physiologically and emotionally, you know, what a gift in some senses. And then if they're using that effectively, they will be more creative. They will be more attuned to their peers. There's so much possibility there. However, if we, again, I'm going to bring it back to the developmental model of, you know, the mismatch between child and environment. If we've got a highly sensitive child and in terms of, you know, the ORCID child, the more sensitive to emotions, I had a former colleague who referred to it as, if your hearing aid for emotion is always on 100. So you're kind of living in this rock concert and you feel everything and are sensitive to your own emotions and the emotions of everyone else around you. And your parent is not. If your parent is, you know, more of a dandelion, there's more room for mismatch to happen. So when the child, you know, expresses big emotion about, for example, stepping on an ant, and they're so upset, and oh my gosh, the mommy ant and the baby ant, and da, 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 they're having this huge emotional response. And you know, mom and dad who are stressed from their workday and are more dandelionish and don't quite get it. It's hard enough to get a 3-year-old's emotion, even if we are attuned, but when we've got a highly sensitive 3-year-old and a less sensitive parent, the parent's more likely to give a response that's not attuned to the child. And so the child's going to feel invalidated. They're going to feel like their emotions are too much. They're going to be told over and over again, you're too sensitive, you're too much, which, you know, I work with a population primarily at our clinic. I work with individuals with borderline personality disorder who tend to experience emotions really intensely and have more often than not lived in this developmental environment where their emotions have been perceived as too much by others. And so they're told they're too sensitive, they're told they're too much, or they're ignored altogether. And so they learn coping strategies to feel seen and heard either by shutting down their emotions altogether and appearing as incredibly competent and all good and all fine, and they can smile through the pain. And so nobody knows that anything's going on, or they express their emotions in really big ways that can become problematic as we get older. You know, big acts of anger, big acts of perhaps like threats and such to get their emotional needs met, because, you know, they live so much of their life not feeling heard and seen. So they've developed these strategies that at one point helped get them heard and seen in the way that they needed. But now these patterns have become overlearned. And so our work together, I'm part of the DBT program at the clinic, dialectical behavioral therapy. It's helping them learn to understand, recognize their emotions and communicate them at a level that matches the environment and that is effective for their goals. And so how can we get your anger heard at a 5 instead of at a 10 when the situation calls for a 5? And how can we show any emotion that it is that you're feeling, again, at an appropriate level instead of feeling like you need to hide it? So it's teaching them how to, you know, tune into what they're feeling and match it to their environment and match it to what they need to get their goals met in life.
What an incredibly important life skill, eh?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Were we living in this culture? And, you know, I don't know about your experience of learning to become a therapist, but heck, I had to learn a hell of a lot about emotions for myself and how to regulate and how to understand what's going on inside of me before I was able to teach this to others.
No, absolutely. And I'll speak for myself, just a lot of therapy on top of that, just to develop the language and the comfort level with vulnerability and not being activated overly by other folks' emotions, things like that. One point I want to ask you a little bit more about the parenting work that you do, because I think it's really interesting, and you can maybe ask you to walk through some of the specifics around it. When you mentioned sort of that idea of someone, you know, learning to be perfect and putting on that brave face and smiling through the pain, it reminds me so much of that detached protector mode that's talked about in the schema therapy framework. And I think what I'm increasingly trying to show a lot of clients is that, yes, you've got the achievement thing down, right? We're going to give you the A+ on that, right? And they've got all the adoration coming in around that. The challenge, though, is that they're not getting any validation for their vulnerability or where they may be imperfect. And of course, it's very scary to show that, but to feel full as a human being, you need both sides of the coin. Like, it's natural to want validation for what you do performance-wise, but then we also need validation for our vulnerabilities and for where we may perceive that we fall short of being perfect. And that, you know, it's very hard for people to, it's scary for people to do that. But one of the tells, I mean, for any, you know, mental health, you know, consumers out there who are listening, one of the tells that you might be operating off of that sort of adoration paradigm is that you feel worse over time when you achieve, not better. It doesn't make things better, right? Like it's just, you know, you have clients come in where it's like, okay, so you've got a university degree and they're saying, well, if I go do all that master's, then I'll feel good about myself. They go do the master's. Okay. Well, it looks like nothing's changed too much. Now I need to do a PhD. And then what's beyond a PhD? Well, I don't know. Right. So you see this arms race of achievement to try to soothe that inner distress, but it doesn't work because what they actually need is to be validated for their vulnerabilities and imperfections. Stacey, is that a pattern that you see, or is that a pattern that is talked about in EFT, or how do you conceptualize a model like that where clients are living off of achievement, but starving with respect to validation for their soft underbelly, let's say?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a pattern that I see. And I see it as, I'm trying to think of how we work with that in therapy. A lot of kind of recognizing that this is happening and grieving the loss of the life that you miss in this striving, right? It's almost like this treadmill of I need to constantly find the next thing. And then I don't know what your experience has been, but I see so many individuals who then come to me, you know, in adulthood or late in life and say, I've been following the rules. I've been achieving. I've been doing all these things. I'm still not happy. I still don't feel okay. I can't stop. I'm so tired. Now what? And so the work becomes on practicing, you know, being imperfect, practicing, making mistakes, practicing, being real, quote unquote, and human, and seeing what happens, which is so scary when you live this life where you think you have to put on this perfect achieving, striving front. But it becomes a matter of slowly doing these experiments, or we try things on and you try it out and you see what happens. And what a beautiful outcome when you see individuals. I'm thinking of one client in particular who I recently worked with who had this like very masculine, very like achieving oriented, you know, mask essentially that he lived in, and it got him through life. But he was so unhappy. And then when the vulnerable emotions came, it would come out as anger, and it pushed people away from him. And he just felt so empty inside. And yet he looked at his life from as an outsider on Instagram, for example, and you'd think, wow, this is like an all-star. But when you got to chat with him, you saw that there was such an emptiness inside. And I think so many of the individuals that I work with on the borderline spectrum present with this emptiness, and how we feel that is we learn to tune into the emotions, we learn to practice being vulnerable, practice being imperfect, seeing how that goes. And when they can connect with that and connect with others on that level, there's just like, it's like a weight lifted when you can just be yourself in life and not be perfect. And just trust your own inner wisdom. In DBT, rather, we talk about, there's this sense of your inner wisdom being your wise mind. It's like this amalgamation of my emotion mind, which, again, emotions are very important in pieces of information. But when we let emotions be the sole drive of our actions, it gets us into some trouble at times, because we're losing that logic piece. And then we operate totally in that rational logic mind, which I think sometimes happens when we're high achievers. It's like, go, 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 do, because this is going to get me the thing. We're totally disconnected from that emotion piece. We ignore our values. We ignore the little things in life that are important to us. We ignore our people and relationships. So this wise mind is that amalgamation of those two sides in our core. If we can learn to live more or less from that wise mind place, where I'm not only intellectualizing everything and overdoing it, and I'm not totally reliant on my emotions, life gets a lot easier for people and a lot less heavy, I've observed.
No, I totally agree. And I love that notion in positive psychology that all of us have everything that we need inside of us to be able to take care of us. But sometimes there's a lot of gunk in the way. That's the scientific term, I'm told. There's a lot of gunk in the way that in order to be able to access that ability to take care of oneself. And it sounds like really beautiful work that you do, Stacey, in terms of helping people clear away the debris and find clarity, make connections, be able to feel their vulnerability and take care of themselves. I was listening to a podcast with Terry Real the other day. I'm not sure if you know who he is or not, but he does a lot of work with men and male rage and men who have been violent, had a lot of problems with violence in relationships. And he talks about the two conditions under which a midlife crisis will evolve are typically when, number one, you realize that your dreams aren't going to come true. Like you run out of runway and, you're going to have to grieve some of the things that were never to be. But I think a more common one, and you mentioned this a moment ago, is that you've lived the dream and yet you're still a miserable person, right? You've got the job, you've got the partner, you've got the house, you've got all the things that you want on paper, yet you feel empty and depressed and sad. And again, often when men feel vulnerability or shame, they'll go to grandiosity and achievement as a way of soothing themselves, when really, I know it's counterintuitive, but it should be going the opposite, right? Going towards the shame, going towards vulnerability, then they'll be able to fill themselves up authentically and not just with like a better car. And again, it's a very gendered example, but it's one that I see, come through the office door.
Yeah. And I think I recently read The Velvet Rage, which is a take on the gay male experience. But similarly, they talk about the risk of relying totally on external validation in terms of achievement, in terms of the car, the success, the body, the dating life, and realizing then when you've got all of these things on the surface, your life looks perfect and you still feel quite empty. And all of those things are so vulnerable, right? They can be taken away. If my sense of I'm doing okay is reliant on my intellect and I get into a car accident, I'm screwed. Or if my sense of being okay is reliant on my body and how my body looks, like inevitably we will all age, we will all change in our appearance. And so it's so precarious. And so the work we do is in terms of helping people go inward, be vulnerable and find that sense of fullness through connecting to their emotions, through using their emotions as ways to connect, instead of relying on this external validation source or external ideas that are so precarious. It's really meaningful work. It's just very hard. We're so wired as a culture to be striving and going and doing and to externalize and be in our heads and be out there. And we're never really in our bodies, but we're glued to our phones. We're go, go, go. It's a work to go inwards, to be vulnerable, and even just to take that time to learn to connect with our internal experience.
Yeah, I was going to say, even just to carve out the time to do that, I take maybe 7 to 10 minutes every morning. And I think this is like those crystal bowls, I use that just to do a quick breathing sort of exercise. I've sort of abandoned for the moment mindfulness and I'm just doing breathing. It's like, okay, if I can just get that done, then I'm happy. But even just finding 7 to 10 minutes to check in with oneself, it's like looking in a window, at least, it's something. It could be doing a lot more, but at least I have a window into that. I find that to be really helpful. The other point I was going to make that came up for me when you're saying this is that, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that achieving kind of works on some level, right? Like it does supply, I mean, it doesn't really work apropos what we're talking about, but it can work for a long time before people realize that there's a problem with it. So again, you often find people showing up in their mid 40s, who have exhausted that particular line of being, and they're like, okay, well, what's next?
Right.
You know, but luckily there's a whole other dimension of existence that can open up to them should they choose to be vulnerable, feel what's there. And like you said before, like just, I think when I've had people have the most, the strongest emotional releases around this kind of work is when they realize that they don't have to feel the incessant pressure anymore.
Right.
Right. And you point out to them, it's like, geez, it must be exhausting having that pressure all the time. And people just break down. They're like, I hate this. It's like, okay, great. Let's do something different.
And it's what a beautiful moment. I think that's one of my favorite moments in therapy when you have an individual in front of you who has that epiphany, you know, and I can even think of my own moment that happened in my own life experience, right? What a moment when you shift and you realize you don't have to be go striving anymore. And what a gift to get to witness this in others. I wanted to kind of touch base on how I understand like maladaptive coping with emotions, because I think the striving fits in right there. So that model of, you know, well, again, I'm going to bring it back to the developmental model. And I'm stealing this from one of my former colleagues, Dr. Adele LaFrance Robinson, who is one of the co-developers of emotion-focused family therapy, and has written a book recently on what to say to your kids when nothing else seems to work. So on these strategies for parenting that I'll talk about in a second, just to plug her for a quick second. But so if we think of in life, there's going to be painful experiences, right? It's inevitable. We're in the middle of a pandemic. None of us could have controlled this. It's a painful experience. And so that's one source of distress. And then we've got the reaction from the environment to our expression of distress. That's another source of pain. So I'll bring it back to kiddos instead of the pandemic to make it more simple. But if I break my toy, you know, the broken toy itself is a distressing experience. And then if I take it to my environment and they give me a response that's not attuned in whatever way. And we know kiddos are so attuned, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen the still face studies where they ask parents to basically do a Zoom call with their babies. And the facial expressions are just to say, that the timing is off, and babies start to get distressed, you know, just the timing of pleasant facial interactions, but timing being off, babies start to get distressed. So we're that wired to, you got to be on the same wavelength as me, mom and dad, when we're that young. And when it's not the parents are always or necessarily malicious in any way. It's just the misattunement piece. So when I get a not attuned response, and now I have my broken toy and a non-attuned response, I've got all of this sensation in my little body. I'm not really sure what to do with it. And the individuals who I'm looking to help me figure out what's going on aren't giving me what I need here, then I start to stuff it down or find other ways to regulate whatever's going on in my body. And so I conceptualize those as the avoidant coping strategies. And when those become over-relied upon, that becomes a big source of distress. And that becomes typically what we see in therapy when individuals present to us. It's because these coping strategies that maybe worked at one point are no longer working, such as, you know, we've got the more socially acceptable ones like achievement and, you know, externally oriented. As long as I do, I can distract myself from the discomfort inside. I can feel good enough that I don't notice anything that's going on. Or I worked a lot with eating disorders earlier on in my career. And so if I focus on my body, or I focus on food, or if I use food to regulate my emotions by overeating or undereating, and the physiological consequences of that can distract me from the emotional experience inside. If I self-harm, if I, you know, use substances, there's all sorts of coping strategies we can apply to forget about those feelings. And a nice analogy that I sometimes use for people is, if we imagine our emotions were like thirst, right? Like it's a physiological sensation that cues our attention to something, that tells us we need something. And if we attend to that need, it goes away. That's a full cycle of thirst. And if we imagine a lifetime where when we were younger, our parents didn't quite get it right enough times to thirst, or we were shamed for feeling thirsty, and we had no idea what this physiological sensation was. And so we come to be adults and we have this sensation in our mouth, dry mouth. We're not really sure what it's about. It's quite uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. I want it to go away. And I was never taught the strategies for how to adaptively respond to it. So I go for a run. and I might forget about my thirst for a moment of time while I'm running. But then I come back from my run and it's probably there. And then I go for a nap and you know, I could probably forget about my thirst for a little while I'm napping, but then I wake up and the thirst is still there and it probably gets worse and worse and worse. And the physiological consequences of it become unavoidable pretty soon. I like to use that analogy in response to emotions because, you know, the consequences of avoiding our emotions is maybe not quite as dramatic, but we see how when we're constantly using these strategies, the emotions don't necessarily go away. We're just finding bigger and stronger ways to stuff them down or to ignore them until eventually those strategies break down. They're no longer usable. Or we get to a point where what I often see in many of the individuals I work with, it's like they've lived a whole life of stuffing. It's like, you know, a carbonated beverage has been shaken their whole life. All the emotions are sitting there right at the surface, about ready to explode. And then the slightest little thing. So I don't know, they get an email from their boss that's like ever so slightly confrontational, cracks the lid a little bit, and they spill and they spill and they spill, and they start to feel like my emotions are huge and they're going to last forever. And they feel totally out of control. And I don't know how to bottle them back up. And so a lot of the work we end up doing is recognizing that that huge experience of emotions, when it does come out like that, is usually because they've been avoided for so long. The thirst has been building for so many years. The pressure has been going on for so long. How do we learn to let a little bit of pressure out at a time, understand it, and slowly release, so that when emotions come, eventually you get to a place where you feel thirsty, you realize, oh, I need water. You grab some water, you drink some water. Nobody's like, oh my gosh, you're such a baby for needing water again. You just drink it and you feel competent and confident, and it goes away. That was a very long-winded story about kind of how I understand emotional avoidance. But I felt like that analogy was really helpful for a lot of clients in terms of understanding why their emotions feel so big, and why, you know, even though strategies like achievement are sometimes socially acceptable and sometimes work in some ways, they feed the problem in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what I find fascinating about the brain? Well, there's so many things I find fascinating about the brain, is that, like, how does the brain keep track of all this, right? Like, you know, we talk about sort of like the pressure building around that need, right? How is that being calculated? If it's not being consciously experienced, then presumably there's not really language mapping onto that particular need, right? So, I mean, I just find it amazing that there's so much going on underneath the surface that we're unaware of. We often just get memos or little hints of what's going on. There's a great book called Stranger to Ourselves that talks about the adaptive unconscious and about how much that's going on is sort of in that unconscious realm. But just to switch gears in terms of conscious awareness, Stacey, what do we think about, or what's the thought around the appraisal of our emotions with an emotional response, right? So feeling guilt about feeling anger, or feeling pride around feeling happy for an achievement, or something like that. So when we appraise, when we have emotional reactions to our emotions, how is that thought of?
So we typically, at least in EFT, we conceptualize it as primary and secondary emotions, and primary being the emotion that fits the facts of the situation. So that would be adaptive, primary adaptive, I guess, when the emotional response would, in theory, motivate you to communicate in such a way that it is adaptive for your survival. The secondary emotion is the emotion about the emotion makes you, prompts you almost to hide the early emotion. Or then if you're expressing the secondary emotion, again, you're cueing shame, guilt, anger, when that doesn't actually match up with your primary. You're cueing an emotional response from the environment to that secondary emotion, not to the primary. Again, you're going to feel invalidated. You're going to feel like your needs aren't being met. You're going to want to hide, right? So if you think of shame about anger or shame about sadness, you're going to go hide in the corner when really all we need is to set a boundary or to get a hug. And so it fuels these patterns misattunement or responding in a way that doesn't fit the situation. Is that kind of where you're going with this?
Yes, exactly. So, and I was wondering how we could help clients to better relate to their emotional experiences with equanimity and maybe not as much judgment, which would allow perhaps them to have a clearer line of sight on what's going on for them. And then, like you say, just take that sip of water as opposed to stuffing it and then have, you know, be dying of thirst, you know, a month down the road.
Yeah. And I think it's so hard to create that equanimity in clients, right? So in DBT, we do teach literally the skill of non-judgment. So of observing, you know, mindfulness, so tuning into your sensations, tuning into your emotional response, and observing it as facts, not as good or bad. So we literally practice taking the heuristics of good or bad out of it, and we observe facts and consequences only. And that can be helpful in terms of, you know, whatever you're feeling is what you're feeling. There's no, we want to become scientists, not judges of our emotions. In that sense, I think that scientist versus judge language is also stolen from Mark Brackett in his new book. and then we as therapists create a sense of safety. So when we can sit with the emotion that they've been hiding, and when they express that guilt or shame about feeling the primary feeling to us, and we can validate, we can normalize, we can provide education, we can remind them of the adaptive function of emotion. We can remind them that your experience here with me as a safe other is different than the ones you've gotten in the past. If they can get that with us and get to a place where they can express that primary emotion in a safe, supportive relationship, they can feel seen, understood. They can see that I can have that emotion. I didn't die. It did go away. Maybe it was really big and uncomfortable, but here I am still alive today. And then hopefully they can start to generalize that learning into their other relationships, into their at least another relationship, and they can feel safe and supported in experiencing the primary emotion out there. Again, we start to see the benefits. They start to feel more and more okay with experiencing that primary, and hopefully the guilt and shame becomes less overlearned. Guilt and shame in response to a primary emotion becomes less overlearned.
Wonderful. I think that's really helpful. Stacey, I know we did want to talk about your parenting approach that you use, and you've probably laid out little bits of it here and there as we've meandered through the discussion, but I was wondering if you wanted to maybe concretely walk through an example of the kind of steps that you would employ around emotion coaching.
Yeah. And so and I'll just to plug the model. So it's pulled from the emotion focused family therapy model. And the concept is emotion coaching, which is training parents to be attuned to their child's emotional response. Now, we use this example with parents, but it's helpful in almost all interactions, right? I use this when I'm talking to anybody, a sales clerk, my partner, friends. And so it is helpful to use these strategies to, you know, it's basically teaching us to be better attuned to others' emotions. And the steps are to attend to the emotion, which literally means don't ignore it. So if I'm going to use parenting as an example. So if our teenager comes home and they run upstairs and slam the door, there's probably an emotion there, right? So attending, this first step of attending would mean literally following them up the stairs and not ignoring that there's an emotion happening. So attending is literally just paying attention to, not ignoring. Labeling is helping the individual put an emotion word or language to what it is they're feeling. And so we, as the coach, you kind of put on our scientist hat, and we look for little facial expressions. We use our own knowledge of emotions. So, you know, this model requires us to become a little bit more familiar with emotions, generally speaking. And we try to help, based on what we see in the other individual, help them put a word to what they're experiencing. So in the example, if my child has run up the stairs and slammed the door, you know, based on the how quickly they slammed the door, I might take a guess at anger, maybe something else though, but I might take a guess at, hey, I'm wondering if you're feeling angry, or you seem to be feeling angry. We want to be tentative in our labeling of emotions. We don't want to imply that we know for sure what the other is experiencing. We want to create space for them to be able to correct us if we get it wrong. And teenagers will probably correct us if we get it wrong. And so we offer up a, hey, you seem, you know, I'm wondering if you're angry, or you know, you just slammed the door. It seems like something's going on. I'm wondering if you're angry. We don't want to ask, especially with kiddos, because if we ask, that implies that we don't know at all. Better to kind of give a tentative guess and get it wrong than to ask, because no confidence is instilled when we're asking the question, what are you feeling right now? More often than not, especially kiddos, have no idea. And so we offer a guess, and if we get it wrong, that's one step closer to getting it right. The third step is to validate the emotion, which is probably the hardest part, which is putting ourselves in the shoes of the other and trying to convey our understanding of their experience from their perspective, which means taking out our own biases, taking out our own interpretation, taking out how we would feel in that situation, and communicating our understanding of their experience from their perspective. So if your child says, yeah, I am angry, then we start to say, okay, I can only imagine you might feel angry because I know you had you were getting your test back at school today. And I know you are really, not happy with how you studied for the test. We try to put ourselves in their shoes. We want to refrain from going to when I was your age and putting our own perspective in there. We want to refrain from correcting their reality. So another common example I give with parents is if your child comes home and says, oh my gosh, I'm such a loser at school. Everyone hates me. We can take a guess that maybe they're feeling sad, maybe they're feeling ashamed. And we don't want to jump to in our validating statement, no, you know, I think you're cool, or, you know, who said that? Or, you know, I'm going to beat them up. We want to take away our opinion, our reality, and we want to validate their experience from their shoes. So, oh my gosh, I can only imagine how hard it must feel to feel like people at school think you're a loser, or to feel like you're a loser. Wow, I can't imagine how hard that is for you. Oh, that's so, so tough. We validate, and then we meet the need of the emotion. So the step four is the need of the emotion, which we need to know the basics again to get there. So anger needs support in setting a boundary. Sadness needs comfort. Shame needs reassurance of the self, and fear needs protection, just as a quick overview. And so in this case, if in the shame, you're such a loser, that once we see the emotion come down, and especially in kiddos, especially in little kiddos, I had the privilege of working with three-year-olds as part of my research during my doctorate. And oh my gosh, you know, if you validate a three-year-old for like half a second, you see the emotion just come right out of their little bodies, and you can see them come back to a space where they now have, they're ready to receive that, the comforting or support in setting a boundary. Or, you know, you reassure the self of, oh my gosh, these are all the reasons why you're so special to me, and you're so uniquely special, to combat that shame. And then the last step in emotion coaching, we always put it in brackets, is fix or problem solve or redirect. And so I think in our emotionally avoidant culture, we're so uncomfortable with other people's emotions, especially the emotions of people we care about, because to see other people we care about hurting hurts us. And so we usually jump straight to fix it. Oh, you're sad. Well, you know, let's go for ice cream with the kiddo. Let's go for ice cream. Or, oh, they're mean to you. Let me have a talk with your teacher. We jump to that fix it place. We try to find a solution, which is an important step, but we need to validate the emotions and go through those first four steps first. Because once an individual feels seen and heard and has had that need met, generally speaking, they're back online with their own ability to use their logic, reasoning, problem solving. They don't really need us to tell them what to do at that point. And usually we're not looking for someone to tell us what to do. We know what we need to do, right? Like if I'm feeling guilty about something, I don't need someone to tell me like, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. I know I shouldn't have done that. Or if I'm feeling, you know, frustrated with, I don't know, my car having broken down, I'm not looking for someone to say, oh, well, you should call the mechanic. I know I should call the mechanic. But if you say, wow, that really sucks. You must be so frustrated. Oh, I can't imagine how annoying that is when you're go, go, go all day and your car breaks down. I get to have that moment of, Yeah, that's exactly it. I feel seen and understood. And then I can go figure out how to call the mechanic all by myself. And so, I'm sorry, I mumbled up some examples there, but essentially we're going attend, label, validate, meet the need. And then sometimes we support the child or the individual in fixing problem solving. But the key here is, in terms of reducing emotional avoidance as our culture, is to not jump to problem solving. We need to meet those first four steps first.
I absolutely love the model, and I really appreciate the examples that you walked through there. They just jumped right out of the earphones for me as being, you know, I can see a lot of those in my own life as a parent. One thing I was wondering about, Stacey, is the model sounds wonderful, but like anything, it's only as good as the amount that it's used, right? And I can imagine for parents, there's some emotional barriers to them employing the model because the reactions of their children are going to evoke reactions in them. Right. And I've often seen and I have experienced, I'm sad to say, the reaction of when your child is anxious or hurts themselves, it activates discomfort in you. They almost become like a threat on some level, and you may become angry with them. It's like, why'd you have to do that? You know, look, you hurt yourself. And really what they need in that moment is soothing. Like they need all those four steps that you just outlined, right? What they don't need is what I just outlined, but because of what came up for me, it was hard, say, in that moment for me to access everything that I would know to do, and just blah, you just get this sort of gunky, messy, schema-driven kind of reaction. So How much coaching do you have to do for parents around helping them to sit with the reactions of their children so they can implement a model like that effectively?
And that's an excellent point that you bring up. And within emotion-focused family therapy, the premise of emotion-focused family therapy is supporting the parent in taking on this role of coach for their child. So it's heal the parent to heal the child, essentially, is the philosophy. And this response that you're saying is exactly what we so often come up against. It's our own emotions as parents or as caregivers. You know, I think of even, you know, you and I work with clients all day long, and I'm not saying that I'm a perfect therapist at all, but I do a much better job validating the emotions of my clients than I probably do for my partner or my family members or my friends, because my own emotions get in the way with people I care about, and can stop me from giving them the most attuned response because I just want to make their pain go away, or it activates my own sense of shame or deficiency or all sorts of stuff. So in the model, we support parents in working through their emotions that come up in delivering this approach. We work through some blocks because oftentimes parents are afraid of, if I do this, then I'm going to make it worse, or they're going to hate me, or I'm going to lose the relationship. Or in the case of this model was originally developed with parents of individuals who have an eating disorder. You know, if I do this, if I push them, if I force them, my child to go towards the emotion, if I bring the emotion up, they're going to hurt themselves. They're going to commit suicide. They're going to stop eating. You know, there's really big fears there that can stop parents from doing the emotion coaching. And as therapists, you know, similarly with our clients, sometimes when our own emotions get evoked, our own fear of, if I push the client in a certain way, or if I go towards the painful feelings, what if a bad, horrible thing happens? It can stop us from doing the work we need to do. So all of this to say, it's important for us to get our own, as parents and as therapists and as loved ones, whatever, to do our own emotional work, to have our own place where we can get our emotions validated, right? Oh my gosh, I did this thing with Jimmy today and it was so terrifying, like help me work through it. And in terms of the parenting model, the approach is such that it's never too late to go back and get on track. So if you had an instance where you got mad because your own, you know, you shouldn't have been playing with on the monkey bars, you know, it's your fault. You got hurt. You know, I don't think we would ever say it that way, but you know, why were you doing that? You know, that thing that got you hurt. And then we leave, and then our own guilt probably starts to sink in, our own like, ooh, I didn't quite get that the way I was supposed to, starts to kick in. The model suggests that then we go back and we apologize and we say, hey, earlier today when you were really sad because you hurt yourself and I said X, Y, Z, you know what, I bet you that really didn't feel so good. I imagine you were probably feeling X, Y, Z, and I can only imagine you'd feel that way when I said X, Y, Z, and oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I just want to let you know that, you know, I think I got that wrong there. So we're modeling our humanness and we're going back and we're using the steps. So I attended, I labeled, I validated the injury afterwards as a way to repair, as a way to really show that I care about your emotional experience. And even when I get it wrong, and even when it's really hard for me, I'm going to come back and I'm going to try again. And at the very least, that apologizing, you know, and this applies to therapy too, I suppose, when we get it wrong, there's been several times where I get it totally off with the client. If we can go back and own, oof, yeah, when I said that, I can only imagine this is how it probably landed and it made you feel X, Y, Z, and that was totally off. That modeling of apologizing and really, how seen do you feel in that moment, right? Like wow, they actually get it. They get it so much they were willing to come back and bring it up a second time. So it starts to create this safety, and it's okay to show emotions. It's okay to talk about emotions. I trust that my therapist or my mom and dad or whoever is going to come and going to try to get it, even when sometimes they get it wrong. Because if you get it right, like, I don't know, I think we used to quote 25% of the time. I don't know if that's based on science, but if you get it right a little bit, it's still creating that air of it's a safe place to talk about these things.
Again, I just really love the model, and two quick follow-up thoughts. I think some of the most powerful and effective therapeutic relationships I have are with clients where we've had a rupture at some point. Okay. And I've had to go back and apologize for an invalidating reaction or not getting it or making assumptions or any number of things that I could, you know, there's no shortage of errors one can make in a therapeutic undertaking. But you know what? I think if you approach it with authenticity and humility, like I say, the person feels very seen and heard, and as they should, you know, like that's what they deserve as a client. And it does, it can really solidify the relationship. And I'm sure any clinicians listening will be like, of course, you know, that that's their experience as well. Things tend to not go well when one or both parties becomes defensive or, you know, becomes self-justifying. I tend to talk a lot about books that I've been reading recently in the podcast. I've noticed they tend to show up. There's this one I just read called Mistakes Were Made, but Not By Me. Mm. It's a great book about the power of cognitive dissonance and the way that we use self-justification to sort of knit up those holes in our narrative that are caused by the errors that we make. And they have this wonderful metaphor where, say, you imagine you're at the top of a pyramid and you're 50-50. You could go either way. I'm going to go back to my kid and I could apologize to them, or I could stay mad. Once you head down one road or the other, it's like, look out, because if you go down the road of like, nope, they're an idiot, I'm never going to apologize, you will just start to self-justify that decision. And one of the worst things that we do as humans is that we'll self-justify that decision by vilifying the party that we have wronged. Like, we just double down on them being bad. We don't actually dilute it at all, right? Because we have this narrative like, hey, I'm a good person. I wouldn't be mean to someone who didn't deserve it. They must have really deserved it if I said that terrible thing 5 minutes ago.
Right.
And you can imagine where that goes, right? Versus if you go down the other side of the pyramid and you say, oh, you know what? Like, I really need that to apologize to that person. Then your heart will open up to them and you'll start to justify that action, which is really positive, right? Because then, you know, you have a full line of sight on everything that you need to see. So all this to say that, you know, that power of cognitive dissonance and self-justification is not to be underestimated. And they have a wonderful chapter in there about relationships as well, and how, you know, couples start out so close and loving each other, and what, you know, just the power, once that wedge of self-justification gets in there, people spiral away from one another and end up hating each other. I mean, I've seen that clinically, unfortunately, mm-hmm. where, you know, you talk in these terrible sort of custody access situations, and it's like, I can't believe there was a time when these people loved each other, but there was.
And you think of like the impact on both parties when we choose that path, right? The person who quote unquote did the wrong and is unwilling to apologize is living this constant state of anger and looking for justification. It's like, it's almost like a cloud that they're constantly living in. And then the other party probably as well, right? You don't get the closure. You don't get the, and so there's this huge wedge between both parties, and both parties are living in these big clouds of emotion. When if you choose the path of going towards the, you know, vulnerability and owning, I made a mistake and I'm sorry, you know, listening to your own, hopefully, guilt, if you've connected with your own feelings of guilt, and the other person is, you know, effectively using your anger, and we get to repair, the relationship does get stronger with repair. Both parties get to feel more calm, and we're modeling again long-term that this is a normal part of relationships, that when conflict happens, if we approach it in such a way, the relationship doesn't have to end. Whereas I think, you know, I see so many individuals who have this model that if there's ever a conflict, then it's over for good. You know, as soon as there's a disagreement, because they've never been modeled that healthy relationships involve rupture, repair. And with each repair, the relationship gets stronger. And in couple dynamics, it's your ability to repair usually that kind of supports how you're going to handle life going on, because you're not going to get along perfectly for entire eternity. There's going to be days where you just get on each other's nerves, and the ability to get through that through repair is really healthy.
No, totally agree. And I think this has implications at much bigger stratums than the one we're talking about. Imagine two countries that are in conflict with one another. Right. And it's like, how far back in history do you want to go to say who started it? Right. It probably depends who you ask and which country they're in. Right. Right? It's probably both countries were not perfect, and both have contributed to that level of conflict that's evolved over hundreds of years or whatnot. So anyway, it seems to be a glitch that's born into human thinking. There's many of these. Stacey, for any consumers who are listening, you know, I was wondering if you could maybe outline, I don't know how many there would be, maybe your top 4 or 5 psychoeducation pieces around emotions. You know, for instance, the idea that, you know, that they're time, and you mentioned this before, they're time limited. They don't go on forever. Mm-hmm. So again, if you could bend somebody's ear for 5 minutes to tell them about emotions, to maybe help them have a better, more constructive relationship with their emotions, what kind of information would you want them to know, or what would you want to convey?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece is this concept of that they're information and they're adaptive, So they are physiological responses that if we can tune into what our body's feeling, in theory, they prompt us towards understanding what we need. And if we can listen to that need and act on that need and get that need met, they do go away. And so they're meant to be short-term, short-lasting. And they're meant to be listened to. And then when we ignore them, they tend to come with some negative consequences. Yeah, I think those would be my biggest pieces of information. I really do find education on what each emotion specifically needs to be really helpful. I feel like so many individuals, I've taught this workshop for parents and for mental health professionals actually several times in front of huge crowds. And I give the example of your child comes home and they say, you know, I'm a loser at school. Nobody likes me. And I ask everyone to close their eyes and imagine the very first responses that they would give verbally. And usually I get, you know, like, you know, who said that I'm going to go to the school and whatever, beat them up. You know, I'm going to talk to your teacher. I think you're cool. Don't believe that. Ignore that. That's stupid. You know, all of these responses from parents and mental health professionals. So we're trained in being emotionally responsive. So these are the responses I get, and we move on, and I ask people to kind of close their eyes now and go back to a time when they were feeling rejected or bullied as a child. We've all had those experiences, and imagine kind of what you felt, who was there, what was going on. And then I want you to imagine that you've escaped this painful experience, and you get these verbal responses of, well, you know, I'm going to go beat that kid up, or, you know, I'm going to go talk to your teacher, or, well, I think you're cool. And asking people to tune into, you know, what are you feeling? How does that feel? Does it make you feel better? Or does it make you feel worse? All of those verbal responses were coming from such a loving, caring place. None of them were malicious in any way. They were trying to meet the need of the child. And yet when we feel them in our own bodies, we feel that they don't feel so good. And so I use that to kind of illustrate that we want to tune into the emotional response. All we really want to hear as humans, as kiddos, as whatever, is, oh my gosh, that sounds so hard, right? Sometimes we can't take the pain away. We just want to know that someone sees us and witnesses us in it. And so, sorry, long-winded answer to your question here, but essentially training people to, we live in a culture that wants to fix, that wants to take away the pain, that wants to make it better, that wants to, you know, don't worry, be happy. If we can start to all learn as a culture to tune into the emotional response and accept the emotion as being there and just sitting with it, practicing sitting with it, practicing getting curious about what it is, what is it trying to tell us, as opposed to seeing it as a problem to be fixed. I think, you know, we would do so much better as a culture if we could just get to that place. And I say all this as someone who teaches this and has been teaching this, I don't know, for 10 years now, emotion coaching stuff. And I still get it wrong in my own personal life, heck of a lot of the time. But if we all moved a little bit in that direction, that'd be really helpful. I guess the last piece is just knowing, you know, sadness is a heavy feeling that prompts us to that's triggered by a loss. It prompts us to go inward, to reflect on our values, to reach out for comfort. Anger is usually a hot, active emotion that moves us towards setting a boundary, defending a boundary. It's come when someone's violated our boundary or blocked our goal in some way or done something that's not okay. Shame rarely fits the facts, but shame usually says there's something about us that we have to hide from our culture. And so generally speaking, I would say usually shame doesn't fit the facts unless there's something actually that we do need to hide from our culture. And in that case, then I would say find a different tribe, right? I give the example to clients, you know, I've got a lot of tattoos and maybe in some circles, my shame would prompt me to hide that part of myself. But generally speaking, it prompts me to find circles where my tattoos are a fine part of who I am. Guilt prompts us, guilt is that like punch in the stomach feeling usually that tells us we've done something that violates our code. Again, if we're listening to that guilt, we make amends, we apologize, we repair, and then we move on. And so I feel like that understanding is so not understood. I feel like I ask people, what do you need when you're angry? And the answer I most often get is like to punch a wall or to eat some chocolate or to go shopping. If you ask yourself, like, would that help a caveman survive going shopping when they're angry? Punching the cave wall when they're angry, you know, going for a run when they're angry, probably not. Right. So we want to ask ourselves, what's this purpose serving, and work towards tuning into that. So that was not a very concise response at all, but
No, I was just going to say that was a very sage and wise response, actually. And there's a lot to unpack there. And I loved all of that. I mean, I think the thing that I would, if I could add anything, would just be really just to dovetail with what you just said, is the power of behavior and our behavioral choices. And for people to know that when you act out the emotion you're in, you typically get more of that emotion. You don't get less. Right. And this is true of rumination or anger. Like, you know, the more people ruminate angrily, the worse they feel. It's not like, oh, I had to vent and get it off my chest. Like, it actually typically doesn't work that way. So I just want to make that point to folks that we have this principle of opposite action. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you're feeling one particular emotion and it's not a fit for the environment that or the demands of the environment at that particular time, try to conjure up something that would be the opposite and not aligned with that.
Right. And I find that with opposite action, again, the idea of fitting the facts. So if the emotion doesn't fit the facts, or the intensity doesn't fit the facts, or the duration doesn't fit the facts. So if I'm sad because of a loss of someone, and it's been a year and I'm still ruminating in that sadness, for example, that's when we want to start doing the opposite of what that sadness is prompting us to do, which gets us going, moving, doing, living. And anger, similarly, when we're just stuck in this loop of it's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair. It's not directed at anything. It's not moving me to, like, there's no boundary to set anymore, especially I think of individuals who have like this undifferentiated anger at the world. You know, again, just focusing on how unfair the world is that evolutionary adaptive? Is it going to help you survive? It doesn't seem to be. Can we do the opposite of what that anger is telling you to do in that case? You know, find some joy in things, find some get excited about something, do something that moves you to feel more participatory in the world as opposed to more excluded from the world.
Stacey, there's maybe one or two other questions I'm going to try and sneak into our window here. One of the things I really want to ask you about is, you know, as a therapist, how do you leverage your own awareness of your own emotional reaction in session to help assist with your interventions? It strikes me that being attuned to our own reaction to what's going on interpersonally in session could be incredibly rich and important information. So how do you leverage that? What do you do with it?
Yeah, actually, my master's thesis was on that topic of the impact of our emotions on as therapists on our clinical work. I think emotions are well leveraged when we use it to help us guide the intervention that needs to happen. So if I'm feeling frustrated, perhaps with a client, I can only imagine that if they're evoking this experience, that this emotion in me, you know, what's the reaction that they're getting from their environment? And so how can I use that to guide my interventions to help them become aware of the response that they evoke in others so that hopefully they can move their behavior in a way that's going to get them what they want interpersonally outside of our sessions. Or if I'm feeling bored in session, that's a sign that perhaps whatever it is that we're working on isn't the meat and potatoes of what we should be focusing on. So maybe I need to change things up. If I'm feeling sad or empathy, right? That is the whole core of our work, where we evoke our emotions, help us tune into our clients' experiences and help them feel seen and understood. So we feel a little bit of that and can convey that empathy and understanding that helps them feel safe to feel those emotions. I think our own emotional experiences as therapists become a problem when they get in the way of the therapeutic interventions that we need to do. So I think of when I'm afraid of a client getting mad at me, or I'm afraid of a reaction that they might have, I might not, if I'm letting my emotion rule, which I, you know, we should be getting our own supervision and consultation so that we can work through when our own emotions get in the way. And I'm a huge proponent of, we should all be doing our own work as therapists so that we're taking on everyone else's emotions all day long. We're facing really challenging situations that, you know, we wouldn't otherwise maybe have to face as clinicians. I think of like, I'm typically someone who's a bit conflict avoidant, and, you know, being a therapist requires that I'm not as conflict avoidant. I have to be able to say the hard things. And so we can't let that fear get in the way of the intervention. So it's necessary. We can't let our own frustration towards a client change, you know, how frequently we call them, or, you know, I think of those being common ones that come up, especially therapists who are feeling frustrated with the client. The research seems to suggest they're less likely to call that client back to book if their appointment's canceled or things like that. And so we need to be very aware of our own emotional responses and make sure they're tools, not hindrances to our work.
I really, really like that model. And one thing that I've stumbled across is that can be effective in this domain is using a schema therapy or, you know, pick your platform of choice where you can get some language up and running really early in the therapeutic relationship that you can both identify with and both use to describe what's going on in the interaction. So for instance, if you mentioned sort of feeling frustrated and maybe wanting to avoid calling the client back, you could have a discussion about it. But you could, you'd be able to couch it within a framework that I think would not feel as threatening perhaps, or I mean, we don't often get to control how our feedback lands with clients with respect to what they project onto that or how it's internalized. But assuming we're coming at it with good faith and we relay it effectively and empathically, I think if we can nest these interactions or what we observe in our interactions within a framework, that can help. It can help really move things forward, because then there's some instruction about, okay, what happened? We mapped it accurately. What would we do differently? Or how could I help you relate differently to what I said? Or what would I need to do differently in order to meet your needs when that threat gets activated in you or vice versa? So I think that's something that I've stumbled across that I would just pass along.
And what a beautiful way to, again, normalize that emotional experiences are normal. They're a normal part of life. They're information, right? Like, it's very explicitly laying that out within the therapeutic relationship that we're using these as tools. They are not, you know, bad things to be avoided. They're tools. And this is a safe place where we express them to each other and use them to guide our work together. So I think that's a really, really nice way to do it.
I'm also struck by, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I'm also struck too by your comment around how difficult the job can be, in the sense that we are encountering the limitations of, we're encountering human limitations all day, whether it be our own or whether it be that which our clients can bring to the table that day. Right. And I do like that idea of people are doing their best, but sometimes their best may not map onto the demands of the situation, but they are trying their best. So just want to be clear about that. But yeah, doing psychotherapy is often an exercise in experiencing, grieving, accepting, being humbled by human limitations. And I think therapy can be profoundly helpful in terms of wrapping one's mind around that and being able to sit with that, because I do think that is one of the central challenges of therapy. It's an absolutely beautiful and lovely job. But like almost anything values driven, it comes with a certain amount of pain as well that one has to, I think, take responsibility for and to bear responsibly.
Yeah, I agree fully. And I think, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I think we all have to find our individual ways to cope with that pain. But, you know, we're teaching people to go in towards their vulnerabilities, their pains day in, day out. It's inevitable that it'll bring up some stuff in us eventually, and it becomes then our work to constantly find ways to navigate our own pain and move that through our bodies so that we're not carrying it and it's not getting in the way of our work moving forward. Because our own burnout, you know, when we carry too much pain and it starts to build up in our own systems of everyone else's experiences building up in us, the burnout, you know, It screws up with our ability to hear and empathize and to use information that comes from emotion effectively. So our own cycles of emotion are really important for the work.
So beautifully said. Stacey, I might slip in one last little question here for you. Have you watched The Social Dilemma yet?
Admittedly, no.
I, for anyone listening, and if you have, you're able to access it, I've accessed it on Netflix. The Social Dilemma is really well done. And of course they have a narrative that they are, you know, like any documentary, you have to be aware of the narrative that's being fed to you, but it's basically about the sort of really destructive nature of social media and, the way that it's sort of predatorily engineered to take advantage of, you know, the way that humans are wired. I can't help but think that, for a whole bunch of reasons I don't have time to go into, but social media and other aspects of our culture really rob us of the environment and the tools to be able to have healthy relationships with respect to emotions. You know, Stacey, you've alluded to this throughout our discussion, but do you have a parting thought maybe on that piece?
Yeah, I think we're becoming a culture that's really good at hiding behind screens. What we know is that we don't get the same feedback from a text, for example, that we do from the visual cues or the vocal cues of a voice or of a face. I was just reading a book that talked about the impact of everyone's living online. They're presenting this like best foot forward and look at how great my life is. We're not seeing the nuances of human experience. So we're setting, you know, everyone up with this expectation that everyone's always hunky dory and everything's always beautiful. And we're always on a beach in Cabo and everything's fabulous. And that's not the reality. And so there's a disconnect forming there. There's a disconnect in terms of communication. There's also, maybe this is my own bias, but we're seeing so much more plastic surgery and fillers, and we're altering our faces so much as humans these days that apparently in California, they're noticing changes in children's ability to read facial expressions just because mom and dad have so much filler in their faces that facial expressions are not being communicated the way that they used to be. I see there's an opportunity with the internet, I guess, to bring people together, to connect in ways in groups and tribes that would have never been able to meet before. But I think there's so much risk for this false sense of connection and, inauthentic, we're connecting through words. It's almost bringing us further into our head. We're connecting through words and photographs and presentation management, not through genuine, heartfelt connection. And we're overstimulating our nervous systems. I can go on forever. There's just so much risk there. I think it's a wonderful tool, but it's highly misused.
I agree. I think there's so much potential in it, but like anything, I think we're in our adolescence with it, and we're kind of just monkeying around with it. I have a strong suspicion social media will end up being the cigarettes of our generation, where, you know, it was ubiquitous, and we look back on it and be like, remember the days when you could put, you know, this online? We'll be like, what? That was, you know, that was insane. We'll look back and say, like, what were we doing? Yeah. In terms of, you know, making like mismatching the environment, I mean, one of the ways to match your environment, your emotions to the environment, is to be aware of what your environment actually is. And social media provides this very distorted version of the environment that you're trying to map your emotional reactions onto. So it's just really, I don't think we are meant to be subjected to these kind of forces at the scale at which they are occurring.
Really quickly, just the impact of emojis as well. I was reading research recently on the importance of having a big, emotional lexicon, being able to really describe our emotions using a variety of words. And we've become a culture that relies on emojis, which, and perhaps it's better than nothing, but we need to be able to have language, not just graphics, for our experience. So I think that's something that might be worth further study someday as well.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And it's different maybe an adult that is fully capable linguistically of describing their emotions to use an emoji because they know what's behind it. I can imagine for a child if that emoji simply becomes sort of an avatar for some sort of vague sense of a physiological activation of some kind, and there's not the language to be able to sort of describe what's going on, that could be really destructive. Well, listen, Stacey, I have truly enjoyed our conversation today. I wish we had a whole whackload of other time to be able to drill down on social media and all the other cool things that we could talk about. I really want to thank you for your time and expertise today. It was a real pleasure chatting with you about emotions.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Excellent. Well, we'll have you back again at some point soon. And congratulations on recent defense of your PhD. We're so delighted for you, and can't wait to see where your career goes next.
Thank you so much. All the best.
Okay, take care. Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.